welcome to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast, where in every episode we explore what is research culture and what should it be. You'll hear thoughts and opinions from a range of contributors to help you change research culture into what you want it to be.
Hi, it's Emma. And for those of you who haven't listened to my episodes yet, I lead the Researcher Development and Culture team at the University of Leeds. My episodes focus on research culture and research leadership. Today, I'm really pleased to be joined by members of the Research Culture Enablers Network to tell us more about the aims of the group and, importantly, why people should get involved. I'm joined by three guests today, so I'm going to start with a very quick round of introductions. So, Rika, I'm going to come to you first, and then maybe you can hand over to Alisa and Cahill.
Great. I'm Rika Nair, and my current role is Research Culture Manager at the University of Warwick. I'm also the lead of the Research Culture Enablers Network. On to Alisa.
Hi, I'm Alisa Clement. I'm a Research Environment and Culture Officer at Imperial College London, and I'm part of the Research Culture Enablers Network and on the committee as well. Cahill?
Hi, I'm Cahill Rogers. I'm Research Culture and Assessment Manager at the University of Manchester, and I'm also on the committee of the Research Culture Enablers Network.
Thank you all for joining us today. So we're here to talk about the Research Culture Enablers Network. So I think probably a good place to start is by telling our listeners why the network was formed, how it came about, and what you hope it's going to contribute to the research culture landscape and community.
So I would say the network was formed in response to three primary factors. So a growing interest in research culture, the complex and evolving nature of research culture challenges, and the essential need for collaboration to share best practice so we can avoid duplication and drive real change. Basically, the network was created to enhance and amplify the work of everyone who is improving research culture. If we look back to the summer of 2023, early REF decisions had just brought greater attention to research culture, with the suggestion that the weighting of the people, culture and environment element might rise to 25%. This was a really strong signal, and maybe it was perplexing to some, but it was also celebrated by many, especially anyone who'd been concerned with the sustainability of research excellence in the UK, especially in the context of retaining talent and promoting research integrity. However, with this change came the need to be proactive, including ramping up efforts to ensure that the professional service colleagues who support REF and the wider research communities at universities would be ready for this new type of assessment. So many institutions were looking to create, expand, and bolster their research culture enabling teams. When I first started my role as research culture manager, I felt overwhelmed by how wide-reaching research culture was and how many pockets of excellent work had already been done by funders like the Royal Society, Wellcome Trust, UKRI, by those in the researcher, developer, and open research communities, just to name a few. But it felt sometimes like we were all working individually on the same issues when actually synergy would be far more likely to achieve meaningful results. So we held an international research culture conference last September at Warwick, which was hosted by our National Centre for Research Culture. And we were delighted by the level of engagement we had, and we plan to hold it every year, actually. But it became clear that we needed more channels for strategic discussion and collaboration between conferences. So that's why we decided to create the network as a way to connect all those who are passionate and knowledgeable about research culture to the point of wanting to discuss these challenges strategically, to identify knowledge gaps and hopefully eventually lead on research on research culture.
Brilliant, thank you. And as you've already mentioned there, research culture is such a wide-reaching topic. And to anyone who's listened to our previous episodes, you'll know that we talk about research culture being something that everybody needs to be involved in. But who is this network for and who are you trying to get involved?
Yeah, so we've started with people mainly in roles like us, so research culture managers, officers and so on, people with research culture officially as part of their job title. But as a network, we're looking to be inclusive, and we recognize that firstly, not all institutions necessarily have the capacity to have one or more dedicated roles for research culture. And in the ones that don't, colleagues might work on research culture as part of many of the roles or as one of the sort of many hats that they wear, if you wish. And also, as you just said, and as Rick mentioned as well, research culture is quite wide-reaching. It covers many areas. even if you just take the definition of research culture from the Royal Society, which many people in the field refer to quite often, it's really quite broad. You know, it covers areas like open research, research integrity, research development, and so on. And so many of the roles that drive research culture change are underappreciated or can go unrecognized, and we would want to include them as well. So at the moment, we'd say that as a network, we want to include everyone who's passionate about research culture and interested in implementing change.
If you're listening and you're now wondering how you can get involved, we will make sure that there is a link to the network in the show notes that accompany this episode. So I'm going to move on to more personal insight into why you've got involved in the network. So we're always interested in understanding what drives people to get involved in research culture work. So perhaps you could tell us what you think the main priorities are for research culture.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. So for me, I think it would be around the job security and precarity for research staff. I think this underpins and exacerbates a lot of the issues in research culture that we see. So for example, barriers and unequal access to fair reward and recognition, obviously career progression and opportunities, retaining talent, as Rika mentioned at the start, potentially research integrity through creating unhealthy, unsupportive culture of competition. And really, it undermines the sustainability of research ecosystem itself. In kind of previous research and development roles I've done, I've kind of seen the sort of impact on individuals that this can have, kind of on their well-being and their almost their sense of self, their sense of kind of purpose as well. I think it's an uncomfortable truth that a lot of the excellent, you know, world-leading research that UK universities do, it kind of they build and trade their reputation on that research, but it's undertaken by staff on precarious fixed-term contracts, you know, without the job security, relative job security that a lot of others take for granted. You know, it's a very complex issue. There's no simple fix. Funders and universities have their own pressures, budget constraints, and their own uncertainties. But I personally feel quite strongly that as the focus on research culture rightly increases, and we shouldn't leave job security in the too hard box. You know, we know from a recent UCU report that there is actually some good practice out there, and some universities, including Manchester, are taking steps to try and mitigate some of the impact of this in different ways. But I think as a sector, we shouldn't just accept the current unsustainable situation is the only way and can't be improved. So I'll pass to Elisa next.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I'm very happy that everyone is working on, you know, different aspects of research culture. I do think, you know, it's such a complex topic and everything is connected to each other. But if I had to mention one priority for me personally, I'd probably still go with widening participation and initiatives that promote equality, diversity and inclusion. I know it's not necessarily new, and most people in the sector are very much aware of the importance of this type of work. But there is still a lack of representation in academia of various demographics, particularly at the more senior levels. So there's still a lot to be done in that regard. I mean, I personally care about it because, you know, I think it's the fair thing to do. But even if you just want to be a little pragmatic, talent, of course, can be found anywhere. So as an institution, you do need to take EDI and widening participation seriously, as that will make you more likely to attract and importantly, retain a broader base of talent, of students and staff. I mean, at Imperial, we do a lot of work on it. We have an EDI center, which leads on a lot of it centrally, as well as committees, reps, and so on that work within departments and faculties. And some of our Research England funding has been channeled towards these type of initiatives as well. So we have an award-winning program of activities led by Professor Sarah Rankin that's looking at ways to encourage more Black students into postgraduate research in STEM. The graduate school is also currently developing EDI training for doctoral supervisors, amongst many other initiatives. So I think it's a really exciting time, and it's so great to see all the work that's being done across the sector. Rika, on to you.
Sure. I think just like Elisa said, it's quite hard to pick one challenge because it is such a complex issue. But if I had to choose one that was close to my heart, I would say a top priority for me is championing parity of esteem for research enablers and really promoting a vision that many different roles not only contribute to, but actually drive research excellence. In a way, my passion for this area is a product of my own lived experience as a researcher and now a research enabler. So during my PhD, it became clear to me that I was more interested in the nature of research and improving research excellence generally rather than the project itself. The BBSRC, who was sponsoring my project at the time, were offering a policy internship scheme, and I was really lucky to have the chance to join the Royal Society Science Policy Centre. This brought me face to face with data on what was already being called at the time the leaky pipeline, where essentially in the UK we were training up many researchers to PhD level, but then progressively losing them as you moved up the academic research career pathway, with increasingly fewer making it to permanent positions and professorships. The leaking effect was especially marked for women and ethnic minorities. So going back to what Elisa was saying, still a key issue at the minute that we have underrepresentation of these groups. And there are initiatives out there, for example, to increase the number of female Black professors, and that's great to see. So I actually consider myself to have voluntarily leaked. And I think it would be helpful to reframe the discussion around there only being one successful journey to academic research. In a way, I feel like I never left research. And even though I'm more of a research enabler than a researcher, I still feel like I contribute to excellent research. The roles I went for after my PhD started out as research project management, but as I took on more complex interdisciplinary projects, eventually across multiple institutions and involving multiple stakeholders beyond academia, these roles became better defined by an acronym, which is called PRISM. And PRISM is a term that is hopefully gaining some momentum with support from funders like the EPSRC. It stands for Professional Research Investment and Strategy Manager. Essentially, the most complex research challenges, if you think about climate change, if you think about pandemics and other health issues, require coordination and input from increasingly diverse teams. And in order to ensure research excellence, you need experienced research enablers who can straddle the technical and operational challenges of convening research teams and their work. That's where PRISMs come in. And actually, 93% of PRISMs are female and 50% have PhDs. So you can see PRISMs might actually account for some elements of the leaky pipeline that never really left research. And if we can do more to bolster the professionalization of these roles, then actually the pipeline might look less leaky and the narrow path to academic research success might look less exclusive. The PRISM network is doing a great job of bringing together colleagues in these roles, and it's hoped that in a similar fashion to the journey we've seen for technicians with the technician commitment, we might see research culture change for PRISMs as well. I mentioned the EPSRC, and they've actively adopted the acronym PRISM and included it in the guidance for the most recent funding call for centres for doctoral training. PRISMs, so specifically those who had previously held positions as doctoral training center managers, could for the first time apply as co-leads. And from talking to PRISM colleagues, I know this little piece of wording has already had a great positive impact for research culture. So for example, PRISM colleagues being regraded favorably in order to become eligible to be listed as co-leads. I'm hoping this is just a start and that there are similar pathways for all the other research enabling, research support, research adjacent, whichever term you'd like to use, functions that safeguard research excellence.
Well, that's really interesting. And I suppose I should put my hand up and say I have voluntarily leaked as well, having had a previous research background. So we've just heard a lot of priorities, and we know that this is such a complex and varied landscape, new challenges that we're identifying all the time that we know exist in research culture. So how do you see this network facilitating that really important knowledge exchange?
Yeah, so for me, the networking aspect and the knowledge sharing is one of the main attractions for being more involved in this network. You know, we know that many of the issues in research culture, particularly those we've just discussed, are cross-sector, and they cannot and will not be solved by any one institution acting in isolation. We also know in HE, and those of us who've worked here a little while, there's an awful lot of reinventing the wheel. You know, we love to kind of all create our own policies, our own way of tackling the same problem, our own way of spending our own little pots of money on kind of essentially the same issues and trying to achieve the same goal. So I think the idea around this network is to try and kind of move beyond that, because it's quite inefficient. You know, so the idea is to bring together people who are working on trying to address the same challenges. So they're already doing that work in their own institution, but to bring those people together to share our expertise, share what we've learned, what worked, particularly what didn't work, how we overcame some particular challenges, so that collectively we can improve things for researchers at whatever institution they find themselves in. So, for example, someone might have set up an open call for research culture initiatives, or even a positive action funding scheme. So it's really useful to learn from people who've done that. What challenges did that bring up? I know, you might bring up with challenges with legal, that actually you can't go and do that. And, so learning, well, okay, well, how did you get around that? It's really, really valuable to kind of learn from. It'll ultimately help our fellow professionals as well as the researchers in other institutions. I previously worked at a much smaller institution which didn't have this infrastructure, didn't have anyone with this kind of specific job kind of role. So having learned, having the opportunity to learn from people who've been there and kind of overcome some of the challenges would have been really valuable. I feel quite optimistic that the nature of research culture discourse at the moment is very much around working in collaboration across the sector. And that sharing comes through really clearly through committee meetings. We're not in competition with each other. In terms of how the network facilitates this, so our meetings are driven by the ethos of sharing what we're working on and where we feel we can help others, and also where we need help. So new members are invited to record that those things, and that facilitates offline networking and contact building. And as well as having invited speakers on different topics, the meetings also have a very practical element. So for example, our road mapping activities encourage breakout groups to identify issues and blockers on particular kind of topics, but also enable us and next steps. So they have kind of practical outcomes rather than just talking about the issues. And we're also trying to cultivate shared resources and access to information. So members areas, for example, has recording of presentations, slides, contact lists, calendars of upcoming events and webinars, as well as kind of monthly updates on funding calls and key announcements, really. It's all about kind of collecting existing resources to save members time trying to find out the same information. And I think really it's about creating that critical mass of people working on priority areas to share best practice and ideally quick wins, and things that can be implemented perhaps with limited resources.
Fantastic. Loads of reasons for our listeners to be thinking about how they can get involved. So we've heard a lot about the aims of the network, and now we know how people can get involved and importantly, why they should get involved. Where do you see your network going and what are you focusing on next?
Sure. So I think next steps for the network have been co-created with the members of the network. So we put to them the question of how they would like us to approach the next steps. And essentially, one of the key things that came up is we should try and find out who is missing from current conversations. So it's been mentioned some institutions don't have the capacity to have dedicated research culture roles. And actually, those individuals would actually benefit from having a resource where every 2 months they could attend the meeting and do some of that networking and knowledge exchange. So some of our next steps are is doing just that, some horizon scanning to see who we should get involved in the conversation. So that includes other colleagues at institutions, but like we've mentioned, these issues are impossible to solve just looking at individual universities or even the university sector as a whole. We need to be considering that research happens in other places. So we'd like to eventually involve colleagues from industry, from the NHS, make sure we've got funders involved and policymakers involved in the conversation when it comes to hopefully the stage where we're trying to enact that change. Other things that we'd be looking to do is priorities obviously coming closer to REF. A lot of our colleagues are going to be involved in preparations, and there's also the risk that things become more competitive as we get closer to that deadline. So one of our priorities will to be to make sure we keep that equitable and collaborative ethos. I'm just being mindful that things will be changing for our members as well. So through the poll that we put out, they highlighted that they would like opportunities to improve their professional development in research cultures. So one of the aims of the network going forward will be to ensure that we've got opportunities for our members to improve their thought leadership. So either through opportunities to talk to the network and present on the work they're doing, through the road mapping, just get used to talking about different areas of research culture, but possibly also looking at specific training, possibly shadowing and mentoring later down the line.
Well, as someone who champions professional development, I love some of those ideas. Really, really excited to see what's happening or what's coming next. You mentioned you were going to be doing the conference again. Is there anything you could tell us about when that might be launched or when you might be holding that, just so that it gets onto people's radars?
Sure. So we're really excited to be hosting the International Research Culture Conference once again at Warwick, and it will be taking place on the 16th of September, and it'll be a day conference. But we are also planning to have a satellite event the next day for our Research Culture Enablers Network, because through the road mapping activities we've been doing online, we've been advancing the conversation very slowly. But actually, if we were to meet in person and do a half a day road mapping session, I think we will be able to bring those challenges forward more rapidly.
So today we've been learning all about the network. But in addition to this episode, there is going to be a second episode with different members of the Research Culture Enablers Network, where they're going to be talking about the roles that research enablers have and sharing their personal journeys to research culture. And I'll put a link into the show notes so that you'll be able to find that upcoming episode. We are just about up to time. I told you 20 minutes goes very, very quickly. So I would like to thank you for joining us today on this episode. You can find links to the network in the show notes. And with that, I will give Rika, Alisa and Cahill the last word and an opportunity to say goodbye.
So thank you so much for having us on the podcast today. And we look forward to inviting and welcoming more members to the network.
Yeah, it was really great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Research Culture Uncovered podcast. Please subscribe so you never miss out on our brand new episodes. And if you're enjoying the discussions, give us some love by dropping a 5-star rating and written review, as it helps other research culturists find us. And please share with a friend and show them how to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and here's to you and your research culture.